everything has a beginning. It's a driving force in our human experience. Every person, every idea, every journey starts somewhere. Whether it's one small step in a new direction or a catalyst that ignites a spark, it's a moment when, from this point forward, nothing will ever be the same. It's not always comfortable. It's not always easy. But it is a start.
Well, good morning. It's great to have you here with us today. My name's Kurt, and I'm what's referred to as a pastor here at Cross Point. Some people refer to me that way. It's great to meet you this morning. If it's your first time with us, we're excited that you're here. As Eric said, this is week number two of our series, Starting Point. And we've been taking a look at how everything has a starting point. And you know, we've been looking at how, you know, your athletic career has a starting point. Some of you already found the ending point, and you've moved on. You know, Eric's hair had a starting point, and it is a continuing point coming up here soon. You know, our relationships have starting points. Our lives have starting points. And one of the things we often don't think about is that our faith has a starting point as well. And whether you know, have a faith in God, or you used to have faith in God, or it could be that you grew up going to a temple or a mosque or a synagogue or maybe even a church, you know, whatever religious framework you've had in your past, at some point there was a starting point. Now, when it comes to the Christian faith, you know, one of the questions we have to wrestle through, which we're going to be doing over these next few weeks, is this question: who is Jesus? That's a question all of us have to wrestle through as we consider a starting point in the Christian faith. Who is Jesus? And, you know, everything else in the Bible is interesting. Everything else is important. It's just not where you start. And so if you weren't here last week, really encourage you to go back and listen to the podcast. I was gone last week, and so I listened to Jeff Mattis. Wasn't Jeff awesome last weekend if you were here? Man, Jeff, I don't know if you're here today, but thank you for a great, great message last weekend. And these all sequence, so you need to go back and listen to last week. And then in a few weeks, we're going to continue to go after this question: who is Jesus? And I want us to just kind of sit on that one right now. We're not going to dive too much into that today, but at the end of the day, we have to all wrestle with that question: who is Jesus to me? Now today, we're going to talk about a word. It's a word, I'm going to be honest, it's a word that we don't like to talk about very frequently, but it almost always surfaces in religious conversations. And so it's eventually going to surface if you're at a starting point in your faith, or if you're at a restarting point. And it's a word that you certainly know something about if you grew up in church or grew up going to church. Maybe your grandma took you to church. And so, especially if you were in the Christian church, and here's the word. It's this word: sin. It's such a heavy, heavy word, and it's really an interesting word. In fact, it's purely a theological word. I don't know if you've ever thought about this or not, but you know, you don't usually use the word sin unless you're talking about something in context to a relationship with God or a spiritual conversation. You know, this past week, we were away with our kids on vacation, and you know, have you ever noticed parenting doesn't cease when you're on vacation? Like, you still have to parent, and you know, there were a few moments where we had to parent our kids, but you know, I didn't say to my kids, you just sinned against your mother. Now, maybe it would have been a little more effective than the way I handled it, but you know, we don't throw that word out right there. You know, if you get called into your boss's office or the principal's office, you know, they don't sit you down and say, let's talk about your sins, right? Or if you get a citation from a police officer, he doesn't, like, issue you a sin citation. So, you know, sin is really something that is purely, you know, dealt with in the theological realm. Now, the other thing about this word that is maybe one of the reasons that we feel the weight of it and maybe even resist it at times is, you know, and maybe it's because it's such a heavy word, is because, you know, when we say that word, I've sinned, It's like so heavy, right? I mean, it's like a giant exclamation point on my life right there. It's like, you know, if I sinned in a relationship, well, man, I'm toast, I'm done. You know, that must have probably ended that thing. There's no hope, I've sinned. You know, there's like no wiggle room when I say I've sinned. Have you ever noticed that? Like, you can't like find a little escape route, like, well, you know, my dad was this way and he did that, and when his dad did that. I mean, when you say I've sinned, it's just so like it's like you look in the mirror and you're just like found out, right? It's like, oh, that's the problem right there. It's me. I've done this. And so, you know, one of the things we've done in our culture, and we've done this for many, many years, is we've kind of replaced the word sin with a different word that's much easier to bear. And it's a terrible word, right? It's really a terrible replacement because it doesn't carry the weight or the gravity of sin. But I understand why we've done this. We've done this because, you know, when we say sin, it feels so condemning. It makes me feel like I'm like on the outs with God. And so you've done this. You've heard this 1,000 times. In fact, you maybe even said it. We've replaced the word sin with the word mistake, right? I mean, man, that just makes me feel so much better. I just made a mistake. And I understand why we do this. I mean, maybe you've seen a scene like this where, like, you know, some public official or, you know, political figures come behind a podium and, you know, said, oh, there's going to be a news conference. They got like 6 microphones in front of them. And they stand behind this podium basically to confess some mistakes, right? We've all seen that, right? I mean, they're talking about how they've blown up their family or blown up their marriage or maybe blown up the city or, you know, blown up the finances of the city. And they just go on and on about, well, I've made some mistakes, you know? And you're just sitting there and you're like, whoa, just the word mistake doesn't quite seem to capture the gravity of what you're describing right there, right? It's like, a mistake is like what I do on the I-step test, right? Oh, I made a mistake. I've marked the wrong one. A mistake is what I do when I'm doing TurboTax and filling out my own taxes. Oh, man, I made a mistake. You know, mistake's what happens when you're like texting and autocorrect kicks in and you didn't notice it and you send something you didn't mean to say. You're like, oh, I made a mistake. But you're like, dude, you know, oh, I made a few mistakes. Blew up my family, blew up my kids, blew up the city. That doesn't quite seem like a mistake, right? And we've all done this, right? We do that. You and I do this. I mean, just to kind of help us feel the context of this a bit, if I were to have walked up on this platform and not told you at all what we're talking about today, I just walked up here and kind of stone cold said, asked you a question, which, by the way, when I ask this question, don't raise your hand, okay? Don't like put your hand. If you're listening on the podcast, you can raise your hand in your car if you want. It's fine if you're by yourself. But if you're sitting in here, don't like do this to your spouse or just keep your hands down. But if I were to have walked up here and said, all right, has anyone in here made a mistake? Everybody would be like, oh yeah, man, I made my fair share of mistakes. It, partly because you wouldn't want to be the one that didn't raise your hand, right? I mean, you wouldn't want everybody around you being like, so what's up with you? You think you're like goody two shoes or something? Like you're better than all the rest of us? And so like we'd all be like, oh yeah, man, I've made a mistake. But if I would walk in here, just stone cold, would have walked straight onto the platform and asked this question, how many of you have sinned? I mean, you know what the front row would be doing? They'd be like, gosh, I don't know. Is anybody else like raising their hand? Because see, they don't know. They don't see what the rest of the room's doing. I mean, when we're like, yeah, I've made a mistake, but man, sin, whoa. I mean, that's like heavy. I mean, a mistake is like, you know, when I just have insufficient knowledge, right? It's like, I didn't know what I was doing was going to lead to this. Well, it's like when I just play dumb or I claim ignorance. I'm just, oh, it's an honest mistake. But see, you know, here's the thing. You and I too, we've used the word mistake about things that wasn't just a lack of sufficient knowledge, right? I mean, we knew exactly what we were doing. And let me tease this out a little bit further, right? Because this is really, really important for us to grasp. All right, see, many times you and I, we make mistakes on purpose. What do you call that? I mean, when somebody gets on TV and they're like, you know, for the last 3 years, I've made some mistakes. I mean, can you make like a 3-year mistake? I mean, can you really do that? I mean, is that really what that is? And, you know, and sometimes we plan our mistakes, right? I mean, some of you booked a hotel room to facilitate a mistake. I mean, it wasn't like, man and honey, I just got caught up in the moment. I mean, you know, I didn't know what happened before I knew it. I was in the hotel. No, you like booked it ahead of time. All right, you like planned it ahead. And what do you call that kind of mistake? I mean, you know, some of us right now are planning mistakes, right? I mean, is that like a premeditated mistake or something? I mean, what is that? You know, it's like the word mistake just doesn't quite seem to carry the weight of the gravity of those situations. And then sometimes, in fact, almost all the time, we make the same mistake over and over and over again. And so, you know, this idea of, oh, it's just a mistake, it's an honest mistake, I mean, it just doesn't quite capture it. And then there's something worse going on as well. Because what do you do with a mistake? Right, it's a C word. You correct it, right? I mean, I have a fender bender. Oh, it was a mistake. You go and you fix it. You know, I messed up on the I step. Oh, I go fix it. You know, see the problem. Here's the problem. The problem is you can correct a mistake, but you can't correct you. See, this is a problem. When we come to that moment of spiritual sanity where we're really honest and we look in the mirror and we begin to realize, see, the problem is me. The problem is you. And let's be honest, you have a really hard time correcting you. And it doesn't matter what, you know, religious or spiritual persuasion you've come from or what spiritual background you have, this is something we've got to kind of figure out. Why am I not able to do what I want to do? And why is it that I'm resistant to the possibility that I might have, let me say it, it's like hard to say, sin. Why is it hard for me to say I might have sin in my life? I might actually have a sin problem. So you've tried to fix you. Your spouse has tried to fix you. You've tried to correct your kids, and they keep doing the same things over and over. I mean, you pay somebody $125 an hour to sit with you and to try to correct you, and you just can't seem to quite, you know, correct you. You've blown up a marriage, and you've blown up a job, and you've blown up a second marriage, and it's because of you, and you can't correct you. And see, here's my point. Here's my point in all of this. See, I don't think we can chalk up all of this insanity to, oh, it was just an honest mistake. I think there's actually something a bit deeper that's going on. I think maybe we need to come to the place of realizing, man, maybe there's something more weighty. Maybe I'm a sinner. Maybe in reality I have a sin problem and I can't just dumb it down anymore. And so let me give you kind of the 101 version of what a sinner is, all right? Because, I mean, there's a lot of misconceptions. And this isn't a theological, like, definition. This is just, like, something I'm giving you to try to hopefully help it connect with you. A sinner is somebody who knows better but does it anyway. Well, that's all of us, right? I mean, how many of us can say, well, there's moments in our lives where I've known better, but I've done it anyway. And here's the amazing thing about Jesus. Jesus talked about sin. And when Jesus talked about sin, which, by the way, I'm not arguing, you know, that Jesus, that you have to believe in Jesus. I'm not arguing that Jesus is the Son of God. I'm not doing any of that. This is just purely informational. If you're here and you're saying, hey, I want to restart my faith or explore what it means to restart my faith, I want to figure out who Jesus is, what he says about what it means to have a relationship with him, and what he says about sin. Well, whenever Jesus talked about sin, he always did it in connection with relationships. I don't know if you've realized that or not, but he always made this connection that sin breaks relationships. So if you've ever had a broken relationship, that means that you probably did something that created brokenness in that relationship, or the other person did something that created brokenness in the relationship, or you both did something that created brokenness, and it was something you both probably shouldn't have done. And so Jesus' entire purpose of talking about sin was toward restoration, not toward condemnation. See, you and I, we always think, well, if we're going to talk about sin, then, man, I'm going to feel really bad. And so that's not Jesus' point. His point is, I actually want to get you to a new place. And so I want to show you a scene this morning, because this is kind of a weighty thing for us to figure out. But we've experienced this thousands of times in our relationships about how there's certain things we've done that aren't just like honest mistakes, but they actually go to the core and ruin or sever relationships. And so let's take a look at this popular sitcom, The Goldbergs, and this scene that really captures the importance of calling our actions what they are. Take a look here.
Meanwhile, my mom was about to get wise to my scheme.
Got a package for Papa Smurfenstein?
I think you've got the wrong address.
I suppose it means there's also no Inspector Gidget?
No.
Gary Grayskull?
No.
Snake Plotkin?
No.
Ivan Drago?
No.
John McClainberg?
No.
Holkerstein?
No.
General Zod?
No.
Jean-Claude Van Thunderdome?
What's going on?
Let me guess. Do you have teenagers? Well, one of them's been using a lot of fake names to get free tapes.
Well, I think it's obvious who's responsible.
Me?
Yes, you. Who else would it be?
Kermit D. Fonz? That's got Adam written all over it.
You expect me to believe that Adam did this?
Yes, Adam. Adam.
My delicious little snuggle monster.
Yes, Adam.
Adam?
He's guilty. Tell her you're guilty.
Why does she say these things, Mama? I'm just a little boy.
See? He has an alibi. He's a little boy.
Why do you always blame me for everything? Just open the box and look at the tapes and you'll see it wasn't me.
Weird Al, The Songs of Fraggle Rock, The Best of Andrew Lloyd Webber, and finally, 101 Farts, Volume 2. Hope it was worth it, Erica. You're grounded for a month. No phone, no crimper.
A month with smooth hair? Are you crazy?
Tell her!
Okay, fine. It really was me. It was such a good deal, I got caught in the heat of the moment, which is also a song I got for a fraction of a penny.
Shh. You don't have to lie for her anymore.
Seriously?
What? Let Mama make you a banana split, okay? You get nothing.
Hey, I got a package for Lucky Goldberg. Gonna need your signature.
Yeah, Lucky's a dog.
Then I don't know what to do. Please don't send it to her.
The nerve of that, Erica. First she frames her brother, and then she ropes in our sweet little puppy. You're not cut out for a life of crime. You're just a cockapoo.
I ordered the tapes. I saw Adam do it, and I wanted in.
Wait. It was you?
With that, my mom finally realized she did blame Erica for everything, even when she was clearly innocent.
Mom, it's for you. Erica's in mall jail.
And 2 seconds later, Erica was back to being guilty.
I stole something else, but you're never gonna find it.
Your friend's weird.
There you are. Classic Erica. You know, I actually started to think maybe I'd been too hard on you, and then you go and shoplift. And the worst thing is, I'm not even surprised.
Actually, your daughter didn't do anything wrong. I was just having her stick around because this one is freaking me out.
It's true. Erica tried to talk me out of it and I didn't listen.
Oh God, my stomach's in knots.
Can I use the bathroom?
This way.
Accusing Erica yet again didn't help matters. Luckily, my mom had a way with words.
So, honest mistake, you know? Pedicures, my treat.
You know, you made me feel like such a bad person that I actually thought about stealing.
Shmoo, I'm sorry.
I don't want to hear you're sorry ever again. No matter what I do, you're always going to expect the worst from me. You have no idea how hard that is coming from you. No idea.
There's my baby. I made you your favorite cheeseburger lasagna.
Pass. I don't want to get blamed if you burn it. So I'll just eat a Lunchable.
But those are for lunch. It's the wrong meal.
Wow, you really have failed as a mother.
Hey, I'm the only one allowed to say that.
Well, it's true. You punished Erica for something I did, almost turning her to a life of crime. If that ain't failing, I don't know what is.
Oh, you're right. I want to tell her I'm sorry, but she refuses to hear it from me.
It dawned on me that I could finally use my crime for good.
Maybe there's someone else who can say it.
Thanks to my scam, there was one tape that was worth every penny, and it was the perfect way to say I'm sorry.
Honey, go away. I'm trying to enjoy my 4 crackers and ham square.
Look, I don't blame you for acting out after the way I treated you.
I really don't want to talk right now, or ever.
Well, you don't have to, because I found a band that'll do it for us.
Sure, Columbia House drove Erica and my mom far apart, but it would also bring them closer than ever.
Everybody needs a little time away.
No, not Chicago.
I heard her say,
stop doing what you're doing.
Far away from their mothers.
Don't make the words about you.
Mishmo.
This is a nightmare.
It's hard for me to say I'm sorry. I just want you to stay.
This is the worst.
After all that we've been through,
will make it up to you. I promise to. And after all that's been said and done, you're just the part of me I can't let go.
And with the help of one soft rock band, my mom was truly able to say sorry.
Couldn't stand to be kept away.
Yeah. You know, how many relationships has that song saved over the years? I mean, seriously. You know, partly because we don't know how to say we're sorry, right? I mean, that's really it. I mean, you've experienced that scene thousands of times. I mean, maybe your husband's come to you and you were just dead wrong. Or maybe your wife has come to you and you were dead wrong and you were just like, oh, I'm sorry. And you're like, oh, that doesn't really convince me that you're sorry. Or your kids, man, your kids, you've caught them, you know, lying to you over and over and over and over again. And they just go, oh, sorry. Can we move on? How about we go get ice cream? And you're like, no, no, no. I mean, it's like there's something wrong with, okay, I'm sorry. And I mean, nobody's jumping up and down going, yeah, great, they're sorry, let's go celebrate, let's go get some graders. I mean, it just doesn't quite happen that way. It's like, no, you've made a mistake that's a little deeper than just a mistake, and you've actually severed a relationship. And I think there's something bigger going on here, and okay, sorry doesn't restore anything. See, as long as you and I continue to act like we're just a mistake, or oh, it's just a mistake, we're never going to be able to seek forgiveness, because see, mistakes don't require forgiveness. I mean, mistakes are, oh, I just didn't have the right information, or I didn't know that it was going to lead to this, or I didn't realize this was going to be the result. And you're like, no, 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 you've damaged something way deeper than just something that a mistake would do. And the only way that a relationship can actually come to the place of healing and get restored to the place it needs to be is when the offender actually acknowledges and embraces the fact that I've made an offense. And okay, sorry doesn't usually cut it. It's usually, you know, looking somebody in the eye and saying, you know what, I am sorry. I didn't make a mistake. I knew exactly what I was doing. I knew what I was doing, and I did it anyway, and I own it, and I just want you to know I'm sorry. See, this is what Jesus was teaching. This was his whole message. It's amazing. See, when you and I, when we think of sin, we always think immediately of condemnation. You know, Jesus is like, hey, let's talk about sin. And we're like, no, 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 let's not talk about sin. Man, that makes me feel so bad. He's like, no, let's talk about sin. We're like, no, let's not talk about sin. Let's talk about mistakes. Jesus is like, no, if we can't talk about sin, then there's no way I can ever get you to the place where you can be restored. Because mistakers don't need forgiveness. See, Jesus knew that as long as you and I are only thinking we're making mistakes, that the restoration we need can never be experienced. And so, you know, Jesus came along and he teaches about sin. And you know, what he does is instead of like dumbing it down, instead of being like, well, listen, it's not that big a deal, or, you know, listen, you're not God. I mean, you can't be expected to always do the right thing, or, you know, you're just 15. I mean, listen, when you're older, you'll do better. No, he doesn't do that at all. You know what Jesus does? People would come to him and they'd be like, man, Jesus, I've done something really wrong. He's like, you know what? You sure have. Let me tell you how wrong it really is and how bad it is. And people would be like, oh my word, we're doomed. We're doomed. And as soon as they felt that sense of we're doomed, Jesus was like, that's great, because I have good news for you. I'm here for doomed people. In fact, I'm only here for doomed people. Jesus would continually say, the only place that I can really do the work that's needed is when we get to the place of realizing that, oh my word, I'm so doomed. And so he'd say, well, does anybody, you know, want to acknowledge that they've got sin? And when we do that, it's like, gosh, if I do that, then that means that I've done something really, really wrong. And that was Jesus' whole point. Jesus is like, God loves doomed sinners. In fact, that's where I do my best work, because I can take you to a place that being a mistaker will never get you. And so here's how Jesus said it. In Matthew chapter 5, he's teaching, and he says this. He says, "For I tell you, unless your righteousness," which means unless your behavior or unless your goodness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees. Now, the scribes and the Pharisees were like the best of the best, all right? They were like the best people. They were like professional do-gooders. They were paid to stay ceremonially clean, all right? So he says, "Unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of God," to which the crowd was like, "We're doomed. There's no way. We're never going to experience the kingdom of heaven." Now, they didn't exactly get in that particular culture this whole concept of hell. They didn't have a lot of understandings on hell, but to not go to the kingdom of heaven was not good. And Jesus says, "Well, unless you're better than the best of the best who are among you, these who always think they're ceremonial clean, you're doomed." And they're like, "What do you mean we're doomed, Jesus?" He's like, "Well, let me tell you." See, Jesus always raised the bar. So he went on. He said, "You've heard it was said of those of old, 'You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment.'" Everybody heard that? They're like, "Yep, we got that." And Jesus, I just want to let you know, Jesus, "I have not murdered anybody." He's like, "That's fine. Have a seat. Don't get too high on yourself yet." He goes on. He says, "But I say to you, everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment." And so when you read this in the context right here, he's basically saying anybody who's guilty of anger, you're basically guilty to murder in the economy of God. You're going to face the same judgment. And they just all sat down. They're like, "We're doomed. We're all screwed. There's no way we're going to be able to work ourselves out of this." And he's like, "Yeah, and if you harbor feelings of anger, I mean, if you've had somebody wrong you and you think about them and you're like, 'Man, I'm going to show them a thing or two. I'm going to teach them. I'm going to make them suffer.'" Then he's like, basically, you've like created murder in your mind in some sophisticated way. And even though they're not physically dead, they probably wish they were dead because you have won, you have trumped them, and you have overcome. And he's basically saying, "Hey, if you know, it doesn't matter whether you murder somebody, you have anger thoughts that lead to this idea of murder." He said, "It's going to be the same judgment." Jesus just raised the bar. And before they could even catch their breath, he goes on. He says, "You've heard it was said that you shall not commit adultery." And they're like, "Well, Jesus, let me tell you, we have not done that," right? My wife's next to me. "We have not done that. We have not committed adultery." And he's like, hang on, let me go on. And then he goes on. He says, "But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent," they're like, "Come on, Jesus, are you kidding? Is my wife in the room?" "No, okay. Jesus, seriously. We've all done that. Who's not done that?" Jesus is like, "Take it easy. Have a seat." He says, "But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart." I mean, Jesus goes on and on and on. I mean, he condemns basically the whole group. He raises the bar way up, and everybody just sits down. They're like, "My word, there's no use. We're all doomed." And then he rushes in, and he says, "That's exactly why I'm here. See, it doesn't end with 'I sin, and so I'm condemned.'" He said, that's what everybody always thinks. He says, "That's not my message." He says, "Acknowledging I've sinned is actually the pathway that leads to forgiveness that allows you to then be restored." He says, "See, if you can't get to the place of acknowledging, 'Man, I've done some bad stuff, I've actually sinned,' there's no way you can get on the pathway that leads to restoration." See, mistakers just self-correct, and they never get there. One day, and you've heard this story, there's all the religious do-gooders in the community, the scribes, the Pharisees standing around, they catch a woman in adultery, and they bring her to Jesus, and they throw her at Jesus' feet, right in the center of the city courts, and the disciples are kind of over here on the side, and they say, "Jesus, this woman deserves to be killed. She deserves to be stoned to death because of her adultery." Now, this was like literal adultery, all right? This wasn't like intellectual adultery. And I tell you what, these are the coolest stories. If you've not read these stories in the New Testament, you need to go find these stories, because these are awesome stories of how Jesus interacts with people around their sin, all right? And basically, Jesus intimidates the crowd away. One by one, the crowd just begins to disperse. And so at the end of the story, it's just him and this woman who was just pulled out of bed with a man she's not married with before him. And his disciples are off to the side. And he does the coolest thing. He looks at her in the eyes and he says, "I don't condemn you." He says, "Go and sin no more." Now let's turn this statement he says around right here for a moment. After everybody's dispersed, it's just him and this woman who was just caught in the sinful act of adultery, and he looks at her and he says, "Honey, you're a sinner. You've sinned and you were caught in the blatant act. But look at me. Look at me. Go. Don't do it again. You're hurting yourself. You're damaging yourself. And by the way, I don't condemn you." And she goes. See, it was only when she came to the point of being able to acknowledge that, man, yeah, I've done some bad stuff. I've sinned. See, we play this game in the middle. We're like, well, I mean, I've just made some mistakes. And see, as long as we stay in the mistake realm, we're never going to be able to get to the pathway of restoration that we so desperately need. And perhaps one of Jesus' most famous teachings, Jesus was interacting with a whole, you know, spectrum of people. And he had people who were just out, and they were really, really bad people. And he's like, man, you guys are so bad. I mean, your mantra's like, hey, just, you know, eat, drink, be merry, have fun, have a good time. You know, it's going to land me in hell, but who cares? I'm going to know a lot of people there because everybody I'm with is going to be there. I mean, so there's that group of people. He's like, man, you guys are really bad. And then he had, like, the scribes and the Pharisees there as well. And these are people who didn't think they had any sin in their life. They believed that they were totally, you know, totally blameless. And so he's looking at these groups of people, and he realizes neither of these two groups on both ends of the spectrum get it. Neither of them understand my message. And so Jesus basically tells three stories in a row. The first is about a lost sheep, and you've probably heard that one in Sunday school if you grew up in church. The second one's about a lost coin, which we don't really get in our culture because it's kind of a cultural thing. And then this third one is a story that he tells that many refer to as the prodigal son. I like to call it the story of the loving father. And it's basically a story about how this son comes to his dad, and he basically says to his dad, he says, "Dad, I wish you were dead. You're not, though. So let's act like you are. Will you give me half of my inheritance and let me go and live my life?" To which the crowd that's gathered all gasps, because they're like, this is like the worst of the worst. I mean, a son coming to his dad. I mean, think even today, if your child were to come to you and say, "Hey, I wish you were dead." I mean, that's just like one of the worst of the worst. And so here's the crazy thing. The father actually gives it to him. Now, here's what's unique about this story right here. See, this is a story that Jesus made up, all right? He's making up this story, and he's telling this to this wide spectrum of people to make the point of how God understands sin, how God understands condemnation, the whole bit. And you know the story. I mean, the boy goes away, takes half of his father's inheritance. He squanders it on women and wine, to which the crowd again goes, you know, they're like, this is terrible. And then the son comes to his senses. He comes back to the father, and he has this moment where it just dawns on him. He's like, oh, my word, I am so bad. I am so messed up. And he comes back, and he prepares this little speech to give to his father. Now, again, this is Jesus. He's making up this story. So this is Jesus making up this little speech and putting it into the mouth of this fictitious boy to explain this important point here. So everybody's listening. You know, Jesus is telling this story. He's telling this parable. And everybody understands that, you know, whenever Jesus tells a story, you're one of the people in the story. And so, you know, they all get the fact that the loving father is actually representative of the character of God. And, you know, the son who's gone and said, "Dad, I wish you were dead. Let me have my money and go live my life." That's kind of like representative of you and I. And the fact that we've done things and we've, you know, done really terrible things that have severed relationships. And there's no way we should ever, you know, be allowed to have those relationships restored. And so, you know, basically, Jesus puts these words into the mouth of this fictitious boy in the story, and here's what it says in verse 21. The boy comes back, and he says, "Father, I have sinned." Now, he didn't come back and say, "Dad, you know, I made a few mistakes while I was away. I mean, you gave me, you know, half of my inheritance, and I wasn't real good with money, and, you know, I mean, I, you know, saw some hot women at the bar, and you'll never believe how much money I spend, and I was just wondering if I could come back and maybe have a job on your estate." He doesn't say that at all. He comes back. He says, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you." Now, I want to pause here for a moment because this is really, really important. These three words, if you've never said these three words, "I have sinned." I mean, you may be meeting with a counselor and your counselor's trying to get you to that point, but you're always like, well, you know, my mom and my grandma, and they were this way. I mean, it's not really me. See, there's something about coming to the point of reality where I just say, you know what? I have sinned. I knew I shouldn't have done it, and I did it anyway. He says, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Now, let me tell you how important this is right here. Basically, the son is saying, Dad, I recognize that our relationship is broken, broken, broken. I mean, I don't deserve the right to call you dad, and you have no reason to consider me your son anymore. I have damaged the relationship. I've severed it because of my sin. And in the next phrase, Jesus blows the minds of everybody who's listening. He says this. It says, but the father said to his servants. See, the father doesn't even address the son. And here's why. Because as soon as the son says, Father, I have sinned. He's like, my son is back. He gets it. He gets the weight of what's happened. He recognizes, and don't miss this right here, he recognizes what needed to be recognized in order for the relationship to be restored. See, if he had walked in and been like, Dad, I'm sorry. Can I have my place back? It would have never happened. It's only because he recognizes I've sinned. And I own it. And I recognize that has severed our relationship. See, the father doesn't even address him. It says, but the father said to his servants, bring quickly the best robe and put it on him. And bring a ring on his hand. Put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet. And the servant's like, but you know, don't you want to know like where he's been? Nope, I see it in his eyes. And they say to the father, but don't you want to know how he misused all your money? He's like, nope, don't want to know any of that. He owns it. He recognizes he has severed something and he's sinned. And now we can be restored. So he goes on. He says, bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead. And they're like, no. He's not exactly dead. I mean, he's still alive. Just the dad's like, no. He was dead to me. He severed the relationship. He said, Dad, I wish you were dead. My son was dead and is alive again. Well, what made him alive? It's the fact that he owned that he had done something that broke the relationship, and now he's able to move to a place of restoration. He was lost and is found, and they begin to celebrate. Now, why are they celebrating right here? They're celebrating because that relationship had no hope of being restored until the son came to the place of saying, Dad, I've sinned. Not Dad, I've made a few mistakes. Not Dad, you know, I wish I would have been a little better manager with your money. He says, I've sinned against my father. And the father says, now we can go to a new place. See, here's my point. When you begin to think about Jesus, when you begin to think about the Christian faith, if you're at a place of restarting your faith, if you're at a place of re-exploring what it means to have a faith in Jesus, when you think of sin and the acknowledgement of sin leading to condemnation, you're actually missing the whole point. Jesus says sin is actually the way back into a relationship with your Heavenly Father. Because the recognition of sin is what paves the way for there to be restoration. See, Jesus in the story is saying, hey, we have to recognize that we've done things that have actually severed relationships, that have broken relationships. And the only way back is to get rid of the silly excuses and the, I'm sorry, can we move on? Can we go get a pedicure? And to say, I have sinned. I'm sorry. And as soon as you do that, you're going to receive something that mistakers will never experience. You're going to receive a forgiveness that leads to reconciliation. Now, I don't know what you thought about Jesus before you came in here this morning. I don't know what you thought about Jesus up to today, but that was Jesus' message about sin. All right, and you need to know that Jesus says, and by the way, we don't have to get too serious about Jesus yet. I mean, we're only in week two, all right? We still got 2 weeks of this series left. So, you know, if you're still like figuring this thing out, you didn't need a message today to tell you that you have sin in your life or for you to know you've done bad things. Well, we know that. But what I want you to hear is God wants to have a party because his relationship with you has been restored. But the only way he can celebrate is when you come back. But you can't come back as a mistaker. You have to come back as a full-blown sinner. When you come back and you say, Jesus, I have sinned. He's going to say the same thing to you he said to that woman who's caught in adultery. He's going to say, hey, quit doing what you're doing. You're hurting yourself. Go. Don't sin anymore. And by the way, I don't condemn you. I don't condemn you. That was his whole message. See, Jesus understood that the acknowledgement of sin was always a means to an end that you cannot get any other way. So we're going to leave it right there. All right, we're going to leave it right there. And I want to give you some homework as we wrap up this morning. So I want you to go ahead and take out your connection card. On the back are some next steps. And we give you these to you each and every week just so you have kind of some tangible ways to continue to pursue your faith wherever you might be. And so, you know, a very practical next step might just be saying, hey, I'm going to come back next weekend. I'm going to continue to track on this series starting point. If you're new in your faith or even just you're like, man, I need to revisit some of this. I mean, make sure you're here every weekend or you're listening. If you're still exploring Jesus, but you're like, you know, this is a different side that I've not seen, I want to encourage you to jump into the Starting Point class. It's an 8-week small group class that just dives into some of these core understandings of who Jesus is and what it has to do with me. So maybe you want to sign up for that class beginning next week. And then there's two questions that I want you to spend some time answering this week. And so maybe this is your next step, to wrestle through these questions. And really, it's one main question. And you can do this on the way home today. If you drove with somebody here, you can have this conversation in the car. You can journal about this. But I want you to ask yourself the question, do you resist the idea that you are a sinner? Do you resist that? And then if so, why do you resist that? All right, kind of dig into that a little bit. And if you don't, then say, okay, why don't I resist that? All right, because that's a critical thing. And here's the thing. Here's the thing. As you wrestle that question to the ground, do I resist the idea that I'm a sinner? That will begin to create the starting point for you to restart your faith. All right, so let me pray for us. God, Heavenly Father, man, I'm so thankful that we get to talk about things that are very relevant to our lives, God. I mean, we all get the weight of mistakes, the weight of sin. And God, thank you for not condemning us, but for loving us and for waiting on us to come to the conclusion and recognizing, man, there are certain things in life that a mistake just doesn't quite capture. God, help us to have some moments of clarity and reality where we realize, man, I've done some things, and it's only when I can identify that I've sinned that I can actually begin to go to a new place. And so, God, I just pray that you would give each of us the wisdom to take what we've heard and do with what we've heard and to put it into application in some way in our life this week. And I pray that in some unique way, God, you'd just visit us as we go into this week, that you'd, you know, show up, that you'd give us a hint, a whisper, something that just shows us that I'm here. I'm here, and I don't condemn you, but I'm here to help you and to restore you.